Hello and welcome to Unfrozen. I'm Dan Safarik. Greg is off today. My guest is Kevin Loughran. He is the author of Parks for Profit, Selling Nature in the City. This is a book about how basically we have privatized the production of some of our most prized green spaces in our cities, which have driven economic progress in some cases, but also has some deleterious results. And that's what Kevin's here to talk about today. Welcome aboard, Kevin.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Everyone knows about the High Line in New York, right? It would be pretty much impossible to write this book without considering the effect of the High Line. Every city supposedly wants their own High Line now. How did you come to select the other two case studies that you're covering, and how did you go about researching them?
Yeah, so the other cases being the Bloomingdale Trail 606 in Chicago and Buffalo Bayou Park in Houston, and a lot of it had to do with serendipity in terms of where I was living at the time, that these different parks were either being opened or were kind of being renegotiated in some ways. And so I was, having lived in New York when the High Line opened in 2009 and then moving to Chicago in 2012, and kind of quickly coming to see, to learn about, you know, the idea that the power brokers in Chicago were trying to build their version of it, and really trying to understand what was kind of similar in terms of driving them from kind of a political economic point of view. And from there, I think that's where I was starting to kind of really kind of like begin my analysis, because I'm sort of trained as an urban sociologist, which is sort of, I guess, relevant for this conversation. I'm not a landscape architect, I'm not an architect, not an urban planner. So I'm sort of coming from outside to try to understand what's going on. And I think in sociology, we're really well suited to understand social structures and kind of what is driving a certain social process, in this case, the creation of parks. But we're not always sort of, because we don't often have a humanities training, we're not always looking at sort of the content of those social forms. And so a lot of my work when I was in Chicago doing my PhD in sociology was to really try to get a handle on the more kind of cultural side and the more sort of almost a more humanities kind of approach to these spaces, and really try to understand landscape architectural history and try to get into what is making these parks so novel. So I really kind of went back to the High Line from that point of view. So having initially sort of been doing research when I was in a master's program in New York, sort of doing an ethnographic study of the High Line and how people used it and the people who worked on the High Line, in terms of like food vendors and cleaning staff and gardeners and security guards and things like that. But then kind of revisiting it more from the design perspective was really illuminating. Digging into the sort of parks history in the U.S. was, you know, I think essential for trying to understand what's going on in the present. And so, again, there was a certain serendipity to being in Chicago when the Bloomingdale Trail 606 opened in 2015, and being able to kind of follow that while that was unfolding. And, you know, one of the things that I found really fascinating, again, from particularly from this political point of view that was my origin point, was seeing how there was pushback to the opening of the 606 even before it opened. Whereas I think the High Line kind of enjoyed a nice little kind of honeymoon period from sort of critics' point of view. The 606, you know, there were protests on it as soon as it opened, right? People were pushing back against the gentrification of Logan Square and Humboldt Park that was seen as being very, you know, bound up in the development of the park. So I was really fascinated to see how quickly there had been this shift politically at kind of a local level. And then when I kind of finished my dissertation, which was primarily about Chicago, and I was looking at kind of the big sweep of urban parks history going back to the 19th century to the 606, and kind of picking out these moments where new parks were being developed. So I had this really nice historical perspective on how things unfolded. But then when it came time to write a book, you know, I felt like the audience that I wanted to reach was probably most interested in the contemporary situation. And at that time I had moved to Houston to do a postdoc at Rice, and you know, seeing not just that, you know, in Houston they had built something very similar, but adapted to a very different context, right? Not using an old railroad viaduct, but using the banks of a river, essentially, that had, even though it wasn't exactly the same kind of site, it had been used in similar ways by similar kinds of people. It was sort of forgotten about. It was sort of an infrastructural site, right? It was sort of surrounded by highways and things like that. And what was interesting to me about when I arrived, again, there's a little bit of this kind of serendipity to the book's construction, was that I moved there in 2017, and then about 6 weeks later, Hurricane Harvey floods the city. And so I was able to be, you know, all up and down the park right after the waters, you know, receded enough to at least get to the site. And, you know, seeing this space completely underwater, because, you know, Buffalo Bayou is not like the Hudson River, right? It doesn't have a really strong current a lot of the time, and especially not when it's, you know, had this deluge, you know, on top of it. And so the water was just really sitting there, and it was, you know, 100 degrees, and the water's just brown, it's full of sewage. I mean, it was very unpleasant to be around it. And so really kind of having that firsthand experience with, I think, the kind of the other side, the side that, you know, certainly sometimes gets a little bit lost in design questions, although I think increasingly, you know, this is a key question about landscape, is how can it have this kind of climate adaptive sort of aspect to it? Can these spaces be recreation and sort of climate mitigation spaces? And Buffalo Bayou Park really was intended to be that. And so being able to see what does it look like in the aftermath of, you know, this is the event that was sort of expected. The park opened 2 years prior to that. What does it look like moving forward? And so even though I think, you know, Houston was a little bit of an outlier, Buffalo Bayou Park, a little bit of an outlier in terms of it's not exactly the same kind of space, I think functionally they do a lot of the same things. And then I liked that it also was able to bring in that climate change aspect in a more sort of direct way.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, and then you also look at the efforts now to kind of revamp some of the existing parks that were always intended to be parks as kind of sponge cities or buffers to environmental threats such as rising waters. Particularly, you look at the big U that goes around, or is intended to go around Manhattan, but has been kind of altered quite a bit from its original conception, and it seems like it's become more of a barrier and less of a park. So that's kind of interesting to see, in some ways, newly planned parks becoming almost more industrialized in character, whereas the trend is toward converting former industrial infrastructure into parks is sort of the obverse. And that's I don't know, that's an interesting kind of juxtaposition that we're seeing right now. So I think, you know, there's a lot of things that are called out in this book in terms of the way that, in some ways, you know, the idea of how could a park be objectionable, right? Like, how could the idea of a new park in the dense urban city be objectionable? But, you know, you point out that these are engines of gentrification and sometimes division, almost in the way that some of the highways and other infrastructure that had come in via previous generations had served to divide cities as much as to unite them. So I think one of the most kind of memorable lines in the book is that, you know, post-industrial parks are a kind of a death show with their zombie plants and their railroad corpses. We've certainly heard the argument, you know, that like the neoliberal real estate boosting approach to parks development is problematic, but do you also take issue with the way that the parks present nature and decayed industrial relics? And what is objectionable about reclaiming abandoned, industrial sites?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think that, and it's a complicated answer. I'll say that there's a few layers to it. So I think that a big part, as you're sort of referring to, is sort of the historical dynamic. when we think about what's the history of industrialization in the U.S., right, as you mentioned, it's often a story about segregation. It's a story about using infrastructures like highways and railroads to divide a white neighborhood from a black neighborhood, for example. And then when we think about the sort of like the broader community level landscape that sort of surrounds these former industrial spaces, these were, you know, homes to working class employment, right? These are places where lots of people had decent jobs. And when those jobs went away through a period of deindustrialization, that's a real kind of loss for that community. And I think that when you look at kind of the development of the High Line and these other parks, they're being driven kind of narratively through this idea of this quote unquote found object. So in the book, I have a quote from Matthew Urbanski, one of the designers of the 606, who refers to the site as this found object. And I think that there's this kind of narrative about discovery, right? This idea that these spaces are so strange and different, and they were just completely off the kind of cognitive map of the sort of white landscape architects and gentrifiers. But that's clearly not true for the communities that lived and continue to live around these sites, right? Who, you know, were often marginalized, because when we think about, you know, who's living next to a factory, who's living next to a railroad track, like, these are not the most desirable places to live, right? And so people who have wealth, white communities are not generally being built around those kinds of spaces. So there's a sort of a recolonization of the sites, of the broader community spaces, that I think is kind of bound up in them. And so where that kind of links to design, I think, kind of comes through, again, part of it is about narrative, and part of it is about how are designers understanding the sites, how are they understanding the community context. And I think then there's this other kind of link. Well, I guess there's a couple more points, but I guess another big link is to this question of like the picturesque, and how, in my, you know, reading of these sites, the picturesque is sort of being reinvented in a post-industrial context. And so when we think about what is the picturesque about, and you know, I think for a lot of us, we would envision like Central Park or Prospect Park or something like that, where, you know, it's the kind of those sort of traditional spaces. But if you go back to kind of what the sort of from like the aesthetic philosophy that was developed by Gilpin and Burke even earlier, right, it's sort of this idea of framing landscape as a picture. So thinking about what is the picture of landscape that is being emphasized and valorized through these designs. And I think that when we sort of valorize industrial decay, and particularly when it's decontextualized, when it's ahistorical in terms of how the design and how the parks are sort of framing it, I think that it's very easy to just sort of see these spaces as like art objects and not as what they are, which is these sort of memorials, right? They're memorials to a way of life that is not there anymore. And they're memorials to communities that have been pushed out of those spaces through redevelopment. And so it's something that I think can be maybe hard to perceive, right? If you're just visiting the spaces and you're like, whoa, this is cool. Look at all this like wild stuff that I'm four stories above the ground, and I'm getting a unique perspective on these industrial buildings, and, you know, these rails are, you know, interwoven with plants. This is just so different that I think, again, we're not necessarily seeing that kind of the broader historical cultural context. So that's, I think, a big piece of it. And then I guess the last piece is sort of about sort of social practices and sort of the ways that what kinds of activities are sort of structured by the parks. And I think when you situate these parks within that sort of history of urban parks in the U.S. and thinking about socially what was driving a lot of the creation of picturesque parks in the 19th century, a lot of it was a reaction to the sort of increasing ethno-racial diversity of industrial cities, thinking about parks as a public sphere that was safe for white women and children, right? You go back and read Olmsted's writings about parks, it's about extending the domestic sphere into the public sphere. And so when we look at the sort of, you know, pastoral ideals and the sort of the design of parks to emphasize passive recreation, it's all tied to that kind of idea of creating a white space in this broader sort of ethno-racial admixture of industrial cities. And so when I see these kind of post-industrial parks really typically, not exclusively, but where the predominant activity is like this bucolic walk through the space, it's really worth asking, you know, who benefits from that being the primary activity? What kinds of, you know, social exclusion is likely to be signaled through that design? Because I think that's a really important part of it too. And I think that, you know, and I think there's been some, again, and it's interesting to watch how these things evolve even in, you know, since the High Line opened in 2009, because I do think designers are showing increasing sensitivity to that. And so like with the 606, there was the construction of the sort of surface parks that had baseball fields and basketball courts and stuff, playgrounds, things that are sort of going to invite wider uses and users. And so I think that's an encouraging, you know, trend when we think about the High Line being so kind of precious and delicate. You know, it doesn't really invite much besides a sort of a walk in the park. And that's nice, and I'm not saying we shouldn't have that too, but I think if that is the only thing, right, we should be kind of critical about what is that inviting.
Do you think there could be an educational aspect to these reclaimed industrial spaces that is currently missing? So I'm kind of thinking about, you know, the debate about demolishing monuments to Confederate generals and things like that, where it's like, let's just remove all reference to the valorization of the bad thing and move forward from there. But there's a counter argument to that is, no, let's keep those things and put them in context and remind people about why they exist. And what about the legacy of those things still exists to this day? Is there a way to do that with these parks? Do you think that's being done?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a way to do it. Whether it's being done is a good question. I think that, you know, when you listen to a lot of the accounts of the designers, like I'm remembering Rick Scafidio with the High Line, there was this billboard framing, I think just to the east of it, somewhere in Chelsea, I'm forgetting exactly where, and that this was such a kind of like iconic sort of element of the streetscape, and that he and the other designers really wanted to kind of keep that as a sort of a monument, as a sort of tribute to kind of what the streetscape kind of used to feel like. And I think that's really cool. But I wonder if people get it, right? Like, I wonder if things like that are so subtle that even if the designers are sort of, you know, thinking about these things, because I think that, you know, designers are very thoughtful about these things in terms of wanting to think about place and think about, you know, making these sort of gestures to the local. I don't know that those gestures are always picked up on. And so to your point, I think, you know, it would be kind of fascinating, right, to see like almost like an art installation at the High Line that had like plaques explaining some of the historical stuff that you might not pick up on, that might describe some of the historical changes that have happened in that area. I mean, I think this is a really interesting question. It's making me think about, you know, the way we often encounter art at an art museum, right? There's often, you know, pages of text, right, that help us sort of understand the social context in which the artwork was created. And I think doing that for parks could be really interesting. And I would be curious to see if that would sort of resonate with people, you know, who, you know, again, especially for something like the High Line that has so many visitors and tourists to it every year, that, you know, having a sort of trying to build an appreciation about that history for visitors, I think would be really exciting. So yeah, I think that's a really interesting thought.
You have a sort of a 3-point, I don't know if I call it an action plan, but you have 3 postulations at the end that are relatively provocative and would change the course of, you know, how these parks are typically done. I think we can kind of go through them one by one. I guess we sort of addressed already the concept of decolonizing the links among race, capital, and the aesthetics of nature. Maybe you can elaborate a little bit on how you think that would be done, and then we can move on to the others.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'll sort of just preface it by saying that I think, and provocative is the right word, and that's definitely what I had in mind. I think, you know, again, coming in as a sociologist, I've so often read books by other social scientists where, you know, they deeply document all of these inequalities, and then you get to the last chapter and it's like these pretty milquetoast kind of policy recommendations, and it always kind of felt very unsatisfying to me. And so I wanted to do something that was a little bit more provocative, something that I thought would be, you know, some grist for, you know, people who have the really challenging task of designing these spaces, because it's sort of easy, relatively easy for me to be this, you know, critic on the outside, but I don't, you know, I'm not charged with actually solving a lot of these issues of equity and access. So I wanted to do something that was provocative that I thought might, you know, create some kind of positive, you know, ferment in terms of how designers were thinking about these questions. So yeah, decolonization of landscape, I think, is super complex. And a lot of it, when I think, again, because I'm in sociology and we are also kind of decolonizing our canon at the moment and thinking about, you know, we have these classical theories and these classical thinkers that have been put on these pedestals for a century plus, you know, maybe we should rethink how important these people are in our field. And a lot of that, so one way to do that is to kind of provincialize the canon. And that really means thinking about these canonical people, and in the case of landscape, these kind of canonical spaces and these canonical ideas about landscape, and really try to contextualize them in the place and time in which they were created. So understanding the picturesque not as this neutral, you know, design aesthetic, but as something that's really tied to British and American Empire. And then questioning, okay, if that's sort of the history of this, what does that mean to reincorporate it in our contemporary design practices? If it has all these problematic connotations, how can we, you know, try to remove them, right? When we think about, as I was mentioning, this sort of idea of like Central Park as a safe space for white women and children, if that is really tied up in, you know, our sort of cultural uses and understandings of parks and of nature in the U.S., how can we try to disentangle that? I certainly don't know how, you know, and I think in the book, I'm really trying to just kind of pose those questions for, you know, designers as well as, you know, social scientists, other scholars, to kind of think through, you know, what are the kind of racial underpinnings of our sort of social constructions of nature? What are the sort of moral underpinnings of nature, right? Because I think about this all the time in the context of like, you know, the like perfectly mowed suburban lawns, right? And sort of why is like a weed so offensive to a certain sort of sensibility about social class and about race? What would be so bad if things were a little bit unkempt? And so I think those are some of the just kind of, I think, the ways into a conversation about sort of like decolonizing landscape and everything that goes into it. It's certainly, again, it's a really, I think it's a vast undertaking. It's a disciplinary undertaking. And I think I'm certainly heartened to see that I think, you know, people, landscape architects who work in academic settings, I think are increasingly asking these questions and really kind of revisiting the development of their own field and, you know, and thinking about, oh, landscape has been this kind of colonial tool in the past, and it kind of still is. And how can we be, you know, agents of a more positive vision of moving landscape into the future in a more equitable way?
Well, clearly we can't really talk about doing that unless we talk about the finance side of things. And one of the other admonitions at the end of the book that you have is abolish private park corporations. I don't think most people know what those are. And it'd be good to go a little bit into what they are and how they, you know, generated these noteworthy linear parks that we're talking about here, and what's problematic about them.
Yeah, I think this is a really good point. It's one that I certainly encountered. Your question reminds me of when I was doing that ethnographic work on the High Line, which would have been, I guess, 2010, 2011. And I was attending a lot of the tours that they were putting on at the time. And one of the tour guides, I remember, you know, mentioned to me that the most frequent question that he received from visitors was, is the High Line public or private? Which I found really fascinating. Which made me think that people have a conception of spaces are kind of in one of those two categories, but that these kind of privatized public spaces are kind of this hybrid that people aren't totally sure what they are. You visit the High Line, you might, you know, see the Friends of the High Line emblazoned somewhere and think, okay, does that mean this is private? And I think that the relationship between these private organizations like the Friends of the High Line, like the Trust for Public Land, and these public parks districts and city governments is often ambiguous. And I think it really, what I found in my research is that it really varies, I think, a lot. And so cases like Houston, where the public realm in terms of parks is kind of so gutted, you know, through budget cuts through to the Houston Parks Department over the last few decades, that the role of private philanthropy has really kind of replaced it in so many ways, and is so much the driving force of what you're seeing, not just with Buffalo Bayou Park, but all of the sort of new parks developments in Houston are so almost exclusively driven by the private sector. And whereas in Chicago, for example, there's a lot more public oversight and public control. So the 606, for example, you know, built, I don't want to get this wrong, but I think it was 95% with public money. So almost kind of the opposite of Buffalo Bayou Park in terms of where the money is coming from. I think what these private groups have done very effectively, I mean, they've certainly realized their goals, right? I mean, the Friends of the High Line, their success was anything but assured when they started in 1999, when Mayor Giuliani and all of the local property owners, or not all of them, but a sizable, you know, contingent of them wanted to tear the High Line down because it was seen as this impediment to redevelopment, as a blighted space. And it really took a lot of, you know, legwork, obviously not just organizing funds from private donors, but also to make an argument to the new mayor, Michael Bloomberg, and his administration that, you know, parks are this economic driver, right? And that became a big reason why that park was built in the first place. And now kind of that proof is obviously in the pudding. And everybody kind of understands that, at least if you're in like an area that is kind of ripe for gentrification or further economic development, that there's no question that these parks are helpful for those interests. And so I think that like groups like the Friends of the High Line, again, I think that a lot of these individuals involved in them had good intentions, right? They were trying to fight for the creation of a public space that would be of benefit to the community. And I think that, there's a long history of groups trying to do that. As I mentioned in the book, right, we think about like a group like Hull House and Jane Addams in Chicago, right? They were invested in, you know, in creating better parks. You know, Jane Addams was very invested in the sort of quote unquote small parks movement. And there's a lot of those that were built on the South Side and the Near West Side in the early 1900s. Because of how they might, you know, benefit the sort of local immigrant and working class populations. And so the difference, I think, then and now is that, you know, Jane Addams didn't say, oh, and you should put me in charge of the parks. We want these are like the Hull House is going to control the park spaces. Whereas today, I think the public has, you know, we've willingly ceded control of the spaces. So the financing, the advocacy, you know, that's kind of one thing. And then I think management is another thing. And so when groups like the Friends of the High Line have, you know, ballooned into these, you know, organizations that really have so much oversight and control a lot of the budget, control the programming, have the ability to close the spaces for private events, there's really this, you know, this kind of creeping privatization throughout that process, to the point where I think now privatization is so normalized that I think it's almost expected, right? It would be almost hard to imagine, you know, like in Philadelphia, we have the rail park, which is the Philadelphia version, and they're trying to, you know, make that larger. It's almost hard to imagine doing a project like that without a conservancy, without a friends group, because again, it's almost expected. It's expected that private funds are going to be raised and that you're going to, you know, perhaps have connections to a national group like the Trust for Public Land, and that the city government isn't going to do it on its own. And I think a lot of us have accepted that state of affairs. We've sort of accepted, you know, deep retrenchment in funding for public funding. You know, we've allowed a sort of a really two-tiered park system to exist in most U.S. cities, where if you have private capital, that's going to be a fancy park, and if you don't, it's probably going to be pretty disinvested. And I think, you know, when you step outside of the High Line and go visit parks around the five boroughs, they don't all look like the High Line, right? Because they don't have the budget that the High Line does. And so I think that's a really important thing, I think, for people to understand. And I think I would, you know, sort of politically, I would love to see more political mobilization in favor of parks funding, because I think that because of several decades of normalization of the private influence, I think that when people want to make, you know, either build a new park or make parks in their community better, it seems like the impulse is, well, let's start a volunteer organization, or let's start a nonprofit that can help, you know, fix this, rather than a sort of a social movement that would demand that the city governments do more, that they give more money to these spaces. So that's kind of, I think, how I see the privatization question, and where I kind of land in the book is I don't see what the value of these groups is, other than to kind of normalize this neoliberal state of affairs. I think that, like I was mentioning, like Jane Addams as a sort of counterexample, I think it's perfectly reasonable to advocate, right, to want to improve public spaces, to have greener cities. These are all good things. It's just this idea that political mobilization ends in private management. That's what I think needs to be disrupted.
Yeah, very interesting. I mean, yeah, I just think about all the logos and labeling that has gone on to public parks, you know, here in Chicago. You know, you think of Millennium Park, there's no way that could have happened without corporate support, although it is very strongly associated with the second Mayor Daley administration and his political new for bringing that together. But, you know, we have the BP Bridge and we have the Exelon Gardens, and it does seem like a semi-privatized space, though, and it has been a little bit problematic in the sense that, you know, we've had restricted access to it, largely because we've had some social unrest here in the streets downtown Chicago during the COVID period, but that park is particularly protected, you know, by third party authorities as well as, you know, municipal police, etc. So it does feel like a sort of, on the one hand, yeah, you do want to protect your most precious assets in the city, but precious for whom, you know, is a question that it begs. Yeah, I mean, the question of what is it and what can you do there is really the operative here, I suppose. Do you think that, you know, following these points, is there a way that we can have nice things without the corporate interests helping to pay for them? Or are we kind of stuck with this model? Is there some kind of legal mechanism that can divorce ownership of... let's call it donation or philanthropic funding from management and operations.
Yeah, I think, you know, and I think this is kind of the challenge, and this is like bringing the design part back in. I think that it's difficult to think about a sort of like, you know, the kind of the nice things question, this the idea that landscape architects want to create beautiful spaces. They want to create these spaces that are you know, that can be these kind of civic landmarks and that, you know, bring people together and, you know, have these environmental benefits. And it's really challenging to think about in the current funding landscape how that's possible without, you know, having a facility that you can rent out for private events. I mean, I think Millennium Park is probably the best example of that kind of use of the space for so many private events, you know, using those private events to, you know, to drive revenue. And I think that that's increasingly something that I've seen, like Buffalo Bayou Park, you know, for example, as part of the sort of agreement between the nonprofit group and the city government was that there were these creation of these tax increment reinvestment zones that sort of basically ensnared the park spaces themselves, where basically the Friends group would receive, you know, X proportion of the revenues that would come from anything, any kind of transactions within the park spaces. And obviously that sort of, you know, only sort of drives the need to then get revenues generated, right? And so how can we have a restaurant in the space? How can we, you know, rent this out for weddings and corporate events? Can we, you know, get fancier food vendors in here where people will pay more for these artisanal popsicles or whatever? You know, how can we monetize this? And so I think that the tentacles of this kind of profit motive are so deeply woven into how these parks are run, that it is really challenging. It was interesting to sort of see, I think, you know, during the mayoral election in New York last year, you know, park advocates, you know, pushing candidates to say that they would, you know, support, I think it was like 1%, get, you know, forcing like these conservancies to give like 1% of their budget back to the sort of neighborhood parks, and to try to like force the city government to kind of commit a larger percentage of its budget to parks. So there is a push to do those things. Those pushes also, you know, they fall way short of saying like the Central Park Conservancy should be liquidated and its assets should be given to the city, right? There's so much entrenched interests, you know, powerful interests on the side of kind of keeping that status quo. And I think the examples you mentioned of like the BP bridge and Exelon, like these are oil and energy companies, right? So there's also a lot of greenwashing that takes place through who are the corporate donors, right? When we think about Buffalo Bayou Park as having this kind of ecological or, you know, environmental climate adaptive kind of aspect to it, who gave the most money to that? It was Rich Kinder, right? Chairman, founder of Kinder Morgan, who drills pipelines to transport oil all over North America, right? So there's this real disconnect there, right? In terms of thinking about, you know, where is this money even coming from? Because in a lot of cases, it's coming from companies that are actively destroying the environment. Boeing, right? Fashion companies in New York, right? These industries that are incredibly wasteful, that create tremendous amounts of pollution, that degrade the environment, want to then kind of take those funds and then, you know, again, greenwash them, launder them through these beautiful new park spaces, which is, yeah, not good. And yeah, so to the question of like, what does the sort of process of dismantling them look like? I don't know. You know, I think the Central Park Conservancy, I can't recall off the top of my head, but I mean, they have, you know, they report hundreds of millions of dollars of assets to the IRS, right? So how do you begin to kind of take that apart? What does pushback look like when you mentioned sort of the idea of like social unrest? What would it even look like to protest those groups like in public space when they have their own private security forces, right? When they can just kind of close off the parks whenever they sort of, you know, decide that they're going to. It's going to take, I think it's really going to take a widespread social awareness of the destructive impacts of these private groups and people to really kind of collectively demand for a different framework for funding and managing these spaces.
Yeah, very interesting. And I think we also have to be cautious of treating this like it's an entirely new phenomenon either, because let's think about the Carnegie Library or, you know, the Rockefellers. What, you know, they've given us all these great public assets that persist to these days, but iron, steel, you know, oil, those are all, you know, these are all the robber barons of the 19th century. I guess it sort of feels like their idea of noblesse oblige was a little less managerial than what we have today. That might be what the difference could be, you know, where it's like, I don't know the history well enough to say that for certain, but, you know, I don't remember there being accounts of, you know, Rockefeller or Carnegie's private security forces then policing those libraries and those parks after they were given, you know, I put in quotes, to the city. So there seems to be a little bit of a difference there, where there's an ongoing interest in, you know, maintaining some level of marketing value out of having made this contribution to the public realm.
Absolutely. And I think the question of like, what's the limit from the private, you know, the private corporation, the private park corporations and the donors, right? Like I look at Houston where there's such, I mean, the Kinder Foundation didn't stop. Well, they were involved. They were also involved with the Houston's version of Millennium Park, which is called Discovery Green. You know, they're just getting started in a lot of ways. They're giving, you know, tens of millions of dollars for this, you know, redevelopment of Memorial Park, which is sort of like the Central Park of Houston. There's so much, I think, that I think from the perspective of the private, you know, benefactors is like, because they have so many financial interests, and that's maybe a difference too with like the library example and the Carnegies, is like, there's so much kind of private real estate interests that are sort of being so tightly connected to the redevelopment of existing parks or the creation of new parks that even if, again, it can seem very sort of, you know, beneficent, but then at the same time, these are people who, even if they aren't necessarily like a real estate developer, their economic interests are very much tied to the growth of their city, right? So if you are, you know, a billionaire in Houston continuing to generate, you know, new wealth is going to benefit you as well. And so I think there's a kind of that ulterior motive at play as well that, again, isn't always apparent. And I think a lot of, again, what I hope to accomplish in the book is to kind of make those connections a little bit more clear.
You know, I, as a sort of wrap up question, you know, with this idea of infrastructure versus park, or infrastructure being converted to parks. You know, I'm a kind of a rail fan and a rail buff, and I'm very much a transit advocate in all forms. I'm wondering if, you know, if there is a way to split the difference and, you know, revive some of these rail corridors as both transit and parks, and thus draw perhaps a little bit more in the way of public funding to their sustenance, which could perhaps be in some ways supported by farebox revenue, especially if we're not just talking about the traditional linear 9-to-5 suburbs to downtown type commuting, which we've seen has taken a major hit with the remote work phenomenon. But a lot of these peripheral railways, I'm thinking of the ones that they're trying to develop in Atlanta, but also the Belt Railway of Chicago, for example, you know, could that be half transit loop, half linear park? And could there be federal funds that come from the transportation and other parts of the funding apparatus for these things that could maybe make the corporate donation and the corporate management a little bit less of a problem?
Yeah, I think that that's one of the kind of the interesting counterfactuals about the High Line is that a lot of the kind of the early proposals, like in the 1980s, to convert the space really all centered on local public transit options. So extending the L train or the 7 train, there was a proposal to kind of change it, I think make it kind of a light rail. I think there was another proposal to kind of use it for like municipal recycling transportation. So it's interesting, again, like when we think about kind of the ecological argument that's often made about these post-industrial parks as them being kind of like positive carbon actors and things like that. And, you know, there's no question that public transportation is the most is a much more positive, carbon act than, a little garden. And this is something I've seen people talk about with like this proposed Queensway in New York, where, it's a much vaster kind of wilderness that's sort of sprung up in the space. And, people have questioned, if we care about the climate question, maybe we should just leave this as it is. Maybe we should just leave this as this kind of unkempt, sort of wilderness, rather than to say, let's make it into a park, because that's not going to be as beneficial from a sort of climate perspective. And I think to your question about like funding, I think, it reminds me of the way that, Mayor Emanuel, I think probably his greatest accomplishment for the 606 was getting federal money through the Congestion Mitigation and Air Quality Improvement Act, or, whatever the name of that funding was, because of his experience in federal government. And not to say that, I'm a fan of his or a lot of the other things he, contributed to that park, which were, fairly negative in a lot of people's estimations. He found the money for the space, and he found it through, through federal funds that were earmarked for, again, for reducing carbon and mitigation and congestion, right? So the idea that the 606, you can actually bike on it, was kind of a novel thing in the context of the High Line, where you very much cannot. Even if they let you have bikes up there, there's way too many people, it's way too narrow, and I think, does it actually even get you from point A to point B? It's hard to imagine a lot of people's commutes would really be aided by like biking on the High Line. I mean, maybe now that there's a lot more housing and Google's now there, there's a lot more stuff there than there used to be. So maybe you're coming from 34th Street to 14th Street and you want to ride your bike. And so sure, you still have to carry your bike up a bunch of stairs. So you better be pretty strong, to do that. But no, I think about that, here in Philadelphia, I think we have, an interesting, again, not necessarily a conversion, but I think, we don't have great bike infrastructure here, but probably the one decent bike infrastructure we have is along Kelly Drive and going from Center City up into Northwest Philadelphia, where it's a very much a commutable, bike trail, but it's also sort of connected to Fairmount Park. And so it has kind of, I think, as much of that kind of dual use as you're sort of pointing towards, doesn't have a light rail attached to it. And so I would wonder what that could potentially look like if we're thinking about like parks and then actual public transportation beyond, because, bikes are great, but I think that when we're talking about doing it at a sort of a scale that is, accessible to lots of people and that would actually invite, a significant sort of like decline in like people using cars, for example, no question that, rail is a big part of that equation. So, I think that's a cool idea. I think it would be, it'd be curious to kind of like think about what that would look like, even like, a counterfactual of the High Line that would combine park and, let's actually connect the L train to the bottom of it. I don't know. It'd be interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think about the Boulevard system too, which was kind of trying to split the difference between, creating a park that with all of the characteristics that you've described, of like making a safe space for white women and children in some respects, but also providing a green necklace that was theoretically for all. These are treated very differently depending on what neighborhood they pass through, right? So Logan Boulevard in Chicago is extremely well used and well maintained, both as a public space park and as a vehicular road. It seems to be less so if you go to Garfield Boulevard in the South Side, which was pretty much the same width and developed the same intent, part of the same system. So obviously it's in the execution and the willpower to follow through on that wherever they go. But there's an example of a linear park that combines transportation, and it's probably wide enough to accommodate all kinds of things. But, under under what circumstances and through whose neighborhoods. And yeah, I think those same issues would still come up. Anyway, yeah, it's a fascinating question, and I think it really does get at these essential questions of how would we want to live in these cities that we have created and modified now to post-industrial uses. So I really want to thank you again, Kevin Lochran. Parks for Profit, Selling Nature in the City is the name of the book, out from Columbia University Press now. This has been another episode of Unfrozen.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Thank you.